Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Genesis Flood when we come back. Well, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1 verse 7 that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Well, every year the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water. 286,000 cubic miles of water every year pour into the oceans. And for century after century, millennium after millennium, this has been going on, and the sea has not increased its level by so much as an inch. Now, how is that possible? Well, we call it the cycle, or the circle, of evaporation and precipitation. The writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx, and because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came, and indeed they do. Every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds, and then ride back to the head of their toboggan slide to begin their journey all over again. Now, in modern science, the science of meteorology is understood and its laws are totally comprehended, but modern science has learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Scripture. And it's one more of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School conducted here at the law school and on compact disc for adult home schooling. For more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org, click on to the email, and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time we took up the subject of the Genesis Flood. If you'd like to get a copy of the book, it's called The Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris, published first in 1963. It's in its 9th or 10th printing. You can get the book in paperback. It's being printed right now in Springfield, Missouri. Just go to your local bookstore and order The Genesis Flood. It's well worth your time, effort, and energy. You'll love it. Now, last time we were talking about, was the flood universal or was it local? I gave you 7 scientific reasons from the Bible that the flood was universal or worldwide. Which now brings us to the second question, was the ark big enough to hold all of the animals or was it too small? How big was the ark? How many animals fit onto it? Well, another aspect of this problem is called the capacity of the ark for carrying 2 of every kind of land animal and 7 of every clean beast that we see in Genesis 7 verses 2 and 3. Realizing full well that the ark was a gigantic structure, remember it's 14,000 tons of displacement, advocates of the local flood theory have had to resort to various methods of multiplying the species in order to make it look like it's impossible for any ark, no matter what its size, however large, to carry 2 of each kind of animal on planet Earth. One method has been to take the phase 7 and 7 in Genesis 7 verses 2 and 3 to mean 14 instead of by sevens. And then to classify all of the birds of the heavens as clean. Jan Lever, the professor of zoology at the Free University of Amsterdam, has done this and comes to the conclusion that of the clean animals and of the birds, there were 7 pairs, of the unclean, 1 pair. There are known at present about 15,000 species of birds, and this means that there were 210,000 birds in the ark, if we take his numbers. But even assuming that there were 15,000 different species of birds in the days of Noah, Dr. Lever has put 180,000 too many birds into the equation for inclusion as passengers on the ark. And that's because the Hebrew phrase 7 and 7 no more means 14 than does the parallel phrase 2 and 2. Now, 2 and 2 means 4, and 7 and 7 does not mean 14. Furthermore, the context demands that the birds were to be classified into clean and unclean, just like the other animals, and Leupold explains the Hebrew expression takes 7, 7 means 7 each. 7 each. Hebrew parallels support this explanation. In any case, it would be a most clumsy method of trying to say 14. 3 pairs of one supernumerary make the 7. As has often been suggested, the supernumerary beast was the one Noah could conveniently offer for sacrifice after the termination of the flood. In the verse 3, the idea of the birds of the heavens must, of course, be supplemented by the adjective clean, according to the principles laid down in verse 2. The birds are separately mentioned so that Noah might not be left to his own devices in fixing the limits of what verse 2 included. Another common method of multiplying the species for the purposes of developing so many animals that the ark is too small has been to identify the species of modern taxonomy with the kinds of genesis. John Pye Smith seemed to find much delight in pointing out that the ark was too small for such a cargo for the innumerable millions upon millions of animalcules must be provided for they have all their appropriate and diversified places and circumstances of existence. But 100 years of further study in the science of zoology has brought to light some interesting facts concerning the amazing potentialities for diversification which the Creator has placed within the genus kinds. These kinds have never evolved or merged into each other by crossing over the divinely established lines of demarcation, but they have been diversified into so many varieties and subvarieties like the races and families of man that even the greatest taxonomists have been staggered by the task of enumerating and classifying all of them. Now, Frank Lewis Marsh has prepared a diagram to illustrate his conception of how some of the typical kinds might have become diversified before and after the flood. He points out that over 500 varieties of the sweet pea have been developed from a single type of sweet pea since the year 1700. And that there are 200 distinct varieties of dogs that are as different from each other as the dachshund and the collie, and they have developed from a very few wild dogs. And in further discussing the matter, Dr. Marsh writes, "In the field of zoology, a very good illustration of descent with variation is furnished by the domestic pigeon. The diversity in form and temperament to be found among strains of pigeons would stagger our belief in their common origin if we did not know that they have all been developed from the wild rock pigeon of European coasts." It is extremely interesting to see the variations from the ancestral form, which are exhibited in such strains as the Powder, the Leghorn Runt, the Fantail, the Tumbler, the Owl, the Turbot, the Swallow, the Carrier, the Nun, the Jacobin, and the Homer. Different species names and possibly even different generic names would certainly be assigned to some of these if it were not known that they are merely strains of a common stock that we call pigeons. It is unwarranted to insist that all of the present species, not to mention all of the varieties and subvarieties of animals in the world today, were represented in the Ark. Nevertheless, as a gigantic barge with a volume of 1,396,000 cubic feet, assuming that one cubit equals 17.5 inches, the Ark had a carrying capacity equal to that of 522 standard railroad stock cars as used by modern railroads, or of 8 freight trains with 65 such cars each. Now, Ernst Mayr, probably the leading American systematic taxonomist, lists the following numbers for animal species according to the best estimates of modern taxonomy. In the light of this recent estimate, one wonders about the innumerable millions upon millions of animalcules which Pi Smith insisted the Ark had to carry, especially when we consider that of this total, there was no need for Noah to make any provision for fishes, which represent 18,000 species. Tunicates, those are marine chordates like sea squirts, 1,700 echinoderms, marine creatures like starfishes and sea urchins. There are 4,700 varieties of mollusks, such as mussels, clams, and oysters. 88,000 coelenterates, that is, corals, sea anemones, and jellyfishes and hydroids. 10,000 sponges, 5,000 protozoans, microscopic single-celled creatures, mostly marine, 15,000. Now, this then estimates that there are 142,000 species of marine creatures. In addition, some mammals are aquatic, such as whales, seals, and porpoises. The amphibians need not all have been included. A large number of the arthropods, that is 815,000 species of frogs, such as lobsters, shrimps, crabs, water fleas, and barnacles, are marine creatures, and the insect species among our arthropoda are usually very small, and many of the 25,000 species of worms, as well as many of the insects, could have survived outside of the Ark. So when we consider further that Noah was not required to take the largest or even adult specimens of each kind, and that comparatively few were classified as clean birds and beasts, the problem vanishes. Jan Lever completely misses the mark when he states that the lowest estimates of the number of animals in the Ark then would be fully 2,500,000. For all practical purposes, one could say that at the outside there was no need for any more than 35,000 animal vertebrate animals on board the Ark. The total number of so-called species of mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians listed by Mayr is 17,600. But undoubtedly, the number of original kinds was less than this. And assuming the average size of these animals to be about that of a sheep, there are only a very few really large animals, you know. And even these could have been represented on the ark by young ones or younger aged species. The following will give an idea of the accommodations that were available on the ark. Now, the number of animals that fit into a railroad car varies greatly depending upon the size and age of the animals. Reports of stock cars and railroads show that the average number of meat animals to the carload is, for cattle, about 25, hogs in single-deck cars, 75, and sheep, about 120 per deck. Now, this means that at least 240 animals of the size of sheep could be accommodated in a standard two-decked stock car. Two trains hauling 73 such cars, let's see here, such cars, each would thus be ample to carry the 35,000 animals. Just 73 cars would carry 35,000 animals, boys and girls, and we have already seen that the ark had a carrying capacity equivalent to that of 522 stock cars of this size. We therefore find that a few simple calculations dispose of this trivial objection once and for all. So just to give you an idea here, the size of the ark was the size of 522 railroad cars, and you only needed 73. So 73 will go into 522 seven times, so it only needed about one-seventh of the space available to hold 35,000 animals. Did you get the drift of this? Think about it for a minute. Let's suppose that you're Noah, and you've been given this assignment. You built the boat to the size and specifications that you were instructed. It's a million cubic feet. In fact, it's nearly 2 million cubic feet. And it's the size of 522 railroad cars. Would you have to take into the ark any fish? We're going to have a flood. Do you need to take in any fish? How about whales? Any whales? Sharks? You see, all of the aquatic creatures, which number in the tens of thousands of species, you don't need to take any of them. They went through. How many of these animals could survive outside of the ark? They didn't need to be represented inside. Now, in a worldwide flood, giraffes cannot survive outside the flood, so giraffes have to come into the ark. Alligators and crocodiles don't. And then take a look at the, a little later on, we'll be seeing huge rafts of logs and vegetation. There's no doubt but what a lot of animals got onto the rafts of logs and survived outside of the ark quite nicely. Or they certainly could have. Those that are equipped for it, like alligators and crocodiles, they're water creatures to start with. They may be air breathing, but they don't have to be protected from a flood. Now, with respect to the survival of plants through the flood, we have this comment from Walter E. Lammerts. He's the consultant in the Horticultural Research Division of Germains Incorporated. He said, "I'm convinced that many thousands of plants survived either as floating vegetation rafts or by chance burial near enough to the surface of the ground for asexual sprouting of new shoots. And I am, of course, aware that objections could be raised on the idea that long exposure to salt water would be so harmful to any vegetation as to kill it. Or, if it didn't kill it, it would certainly reduce its vitality so as to make root and new shoot formation impossible. However, I see no reason at all to postulate that the salt content of the ocean at the time of the flood was as high as it is today. In fact, on the basis of the canopy theory, we would most certainly expect that the salt content of the ocean before the flood would be diluted perhaps by one half. Naturally, during the first few hundred years after the flood, the salt content of the ocean would again be rather rapidly raised because of the much above normal drainage off of the land surfaces. Now, Marsh further suggests that there was doubtless a considerable number of plants which were carried through the flood in the form of seeds, which composed a portion of the large store of food catched in the ark, but most of the vegetation sprang up here and there, wherever the propagules were able to survive the flood. Well, how about caring for the animals in the ark? If there were 35,000 animals in the ark, how could 8 people feed them, haul the manure away, and care for them? Now, I'm an old-timey farmer. I've been in the dairy business for many years. And I know how much manure is produced, 35 pounds a day from a cow. So if I locked a cow up in confined quarters, and sometimes we do that on a feedlot or in a feed pen, we then have to clean the pen up. In the spring of the year, we might clean up and find that we've got several tons of manure that needs to be packed out. And that's just from 100 cows. Several tons from 100 cows. Well, 35 pounds a day. So when you got 100 cows, that's 3,500 pounds a day. You know, that's 1 3/4 tons per day, and you lock them up for 4 or 5 months. How much is that? 120 days at 1.75 times 120 is 210 tons. And that's just from 100 animals, 100 cows. Now, what are you going to do with elephants and lions and tigers and cows and sheep and horses and pigs? I mean, you know, many of them, there's only 2 of a kind, 2 horses, but then, shucks, you know, you got lots of unclean animals. 35,000 animals in here that would average the size of a sheep. Now, it takes 7 sheep to equal 1 cow. So if we took 35, divided that by 7, we'd come up with 5 pounds per day per animal. That's the waste product. 5 pounds per day. Times 35,000. 35,000 times 5 is 175,000 divided by 2,000 is 87 tons of manure a day being created by 35,000 animals the size of a sheep. Can 8 people handle 87 tons a day? And that's only half the job, boys and girls, because now you got to feed those animals. You got to feed them. Huh. Well, that's quite a little job, too. Because whatever's coming out the back end had to go in the front end. And that means that you had to feed those guys 87 tons. Now, this flood lasted 371 days. So let's just move this up a little bit and see what we're dealing with here. 35,000 animals times 5 is 175,000 pounds a day. 35,000 times 5 pounds is 175,000. You divide that by 2,000, and we're talking about 87 and a half tons of feed that have to be put into those animals, and 87 and a half tons of feed coming out of those animals, and there are only 8 people on the ark. So let's take 87 and a half times 2. Let's see if we got this right. 87.5 times 2 is 175 tons a day. Get this. 175 tons divided by 8 is 21.8 tons per person per day. Okay? Now, that's the amount that goes on a semi-truck. A semi-truck holds about 40,000 pounds of cargo and weighs about 40,000 pounds. So, picture this. Each one of these eight people on the ark feeding 35,000 animals are putting one semi-load into those animals and taking it out of those animals every day. Is that possible? Well, I don't have enough energy in my body to do that. Old George couldn't do that. So there's got to be an answer to this. And it's called caring for the animals in the ark. Granting, then, that the ark was large enough to carry two of every kind of land animal, how could Noah and his family have cared for those animals during the year of the flood? Ram fears that the task of carrying away the manure and bringing food would completely overtax the eight people in the ark. And he quotes F. H. Woods in the Hastings Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics to the effect that not even the most skilled modern zoologists could have coped with such a task. Arthur Custance multiplies the difficulties even more when he says, many commentators have calculated the size of the ark and the total number of species in the world and spoken freely of its capacity to carry them. What they do not always remember is that such animals need attention and food, and carnivorous animals, if they existed as such, requiring meat, which would have to be stored up for one whole year. In any case, a sufficient supply of water for drinking would probably have to be taken on board, since the mingling of the waters in the worldwide flood would presumably render it unfit to drink. And it's rather difficult to visualize a flood of worldwide proportions. But with so little turbulence that four men, perhaps helped by their womenfolk, were able to care for such a flock, it would take very little unsteadiness to make the larger animals almost unmanageable. It becomes even more difficult to conceive as to how proper provision could have been made for many animals which spend much of their time in the water, such as crocodiles, seals, and whales. Now, since the Bible does not give us any details on these points, we are, of course, unable to speak dogmatically as to the methods which were, in fact, used in caring for those animals. We would suggest, then, the reasonable possibility that the mysterious and remarkable factor of animal physiology, known as hibernation, may have been involved here. There are various types of dormancy in animals, with many different types of physiologic and metabolic responses. But it is still an important and widespread mechanism in the animal kingdom for surviving periods of climactic adversity. Hibernation and escape from heat or drought occur in every group of vertebrates except birds, and its predisposing causes, immediate and remote, are by no means uniform. Hibernation is usually associated with winter sleep. Estivation, which is escape from heat or drought, with escape from summer heat and drought, other factors also apparently are often involved, such as food shortage, carbon dioxide in the environment, and accumulation of fat. Practically all reptiles and amphibians have the capacity of hibernation. Mammals, being warm-blooded, do not have as great a need for it, and so at present relatively few practice it. Nevertheless, it is probable that the latent ability to hibernate is present in practically all mammals. Now, the zoological dispersion of the hibernation among animals is not especially illuminating, since closely allied forms may differ very radically in this respect. Hibernation is reported for the orders, lowest order of mammals, the pouch mammals, the bugs, bats, rats, lions, and similarly many of the invertebrates hibernate in some fashion for long periods of time. Now, although it is sometimes said that birds do not hibernate, it is now known that at least one bird, the poor will bird, does so, and the hummingbird also exhibits nightly many of the characteristics of hibernation, so that fundamentally it can be said that birds also possess the latent capacity of hibernation. Now, apparently, the reason more of them do not practice hibernation is that their power of flight makes long migrations a more effective means of coping with the adverse weather and other conditions. It is well known that many species of birds migrate thousands of miles with unerring accuracy between their summer and winter homes. But it is not so well known, but it is true nonetheless, that many kinds of mammals also migrate long distances to escape unfavorable weather. Now, the homing instinct also seems strongly developed, and in many mammals, both for birds and mammals. However, the mechanism of the migratory instinct is one of the greatest unsolved puzzles in biology. Well, hang on here, boys and girls. We got to take a little break. I'm going to put a little mark right there in the margin, give you a reminder. We'll be back with more. We're talking about the size of the ark and the attendant problems of feeding and hauling the manure away for 35,000 animals, which totals 21.8 tons a day. And all of a sudden, the logical conclusion is, since it's physically impossible to do that, many of those animals, if not all of them, went into hibernation for the year that they were on board the ark. Nothing religious about that. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. And remember, the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. or call the Law School Direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the Genesis Flood. The Genesis Flood is written by Whitcomb and Morris in 1963. It's available in paperback. The copy I'm looking at here I bought back in 1963. It's pretty old, worn, and dog-eared. I've read it several times. I've used it as a teaching aid and a textbook over the years. And oftentimes I'm asked questions about the Bible. People will ask me, how can you believe in God and the Bible when it is totally unscientific? How can you believe in the Bible when it is totally unscientific? That's what I'm asked. I was not aware that the Bible was unscientific. That was news to me. So I usually ask, well, could you point to just one scientific inaccuracy in the Bible? Just point it out to me, could you? Most people at that point in time are so biblically illiterate that they just shake their heads in disgusted disbelief that you would even ask such a question. And they just turn and walk away. Once in a while, they'll say, well, you know, Noah's flood. That's totally unscientific. So that's why I thought I would share with you this science. This is a college-level science textbook. Let me repeat that. This is a college-level science textbook written by Whitcomb, who is a preacher, and Morris, who is a hydrologist, both of them scientists. And they took the position, let's just be the devil's advocate, and they said, well, if we took the hard science that we know about, and then we took the biblical description of what the hard science shows us, are they compatible? And the answer is they are 100% compatible. 100%. Take that same hard data and use that in evolutionary explanations, and it falls right on its face. In the first place that evolution falls on its face is in the laws of thermodynamics. Coming right out of the chute. If you ask the question, where does mass and matter come from? They tell you it has always existed. And that's not scientifically true. That is not accurate. Mass and matter have not always existed. Mass and matter are going out of existence. They are not coming into existence, and no one has ever seen mass or matter come into existence. And it's called entropy. Entropy. E-N-T-R-O-P-Y, I believe it is. Now, if you take a look at the world from the point of view of the Scripture, it says that mass and matter were created. That there was a guy here who antedates. He was here before. He was before mass and matter. That's why he says, I am that I am. He said, I have no beginning, and I have no end. Now, these are concepts in physics that just blow your mind away. You know, you're sitting here saying, well, wait a minute, how can this be? Scientifically, it's exactly correct. Whoever it is that created mass and matter has to have eternal existence, because mass and matter do not. And in the final analogy, all of the mass and matter in the universe is going to burn itself out. At some indefinite period of time in the future, it's going to burn up. It's going to run down. If you take a look at our sun, it's being consumed at the rate of 5 feet an hour. In 120,000 years, the sun that heats our Earth today is going to be non-existent. At the rate that it is consuming itself right now, 120,000 years, is all the time it's got left. Now, they talk about scientists, you know, these are the people that have PhDs and can think. The rest of us are dunderheads. We can't think. But the people that can think, the real scientists out there, they teach us evolutionary philosophy and uniformitarian geology. And they tell us that the dinosaurs died 65 million years ago. Do you remember that? 65 million years ago. They talk about billions and billions of years ago. They talk about man coming into existence here within the last 100,000 years. Somehow or another, we evolved from monkeys and apes. Do you remember that? But they go back into the strata and they say, well, this strata here is 100,000, 200,000. This strata over here is 20 million, 50 million, 500 million, 400, 600, you know, so many millions or so many billions of years old. Well, listen to this. If the sun, consuming itself at the rate of 5 feet per day, and if we follow uniformitarian geology, if we just accept their statements, I'm not adding anything to it or taking anything away from it. They tell us, they told me when I went to the Eureka High School, they told me in the science class that everything that's going on today is what has been going on forever in the past and will continue to go on forever into the future. It's called uniformitarianism. I believed it. I didn't have any reason not to. The guy that was telling me this story over here was Mr. Turner, our science teacher. Surely Mr. Turner wouldn't lie to us. I'm sure he was sincere. I'm sure he meant what he said. My God, boys and girls, if you can't believe your science teacher, who can you believe? So Mr. Turner explained from the textbooks, you know, those shiny, glossy, paged textbooks, that has all these numbers in there, you know, 20 million years ago, 50 million years ago, 100 million years ago, 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs died out. And of course, at that time, they didn't know why. They've got a lot of theories out there, you know, today that says, well, we think maybe it was a comet, or maybe it was a, you know, a big meteor or asteroid or something like that that struck somewhere down close to the Yucatan Peninsula. Okay, I don't know what did it, but they say it was 65 million years ago. Now get your pen and paper out here, boys and girls, and let's do a little arithmetic. You know, Charles Lyell, one of the pillars of modern geology, published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Now, Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe these concepts don't even know who it was that originated them. So I just told you, it's Charles Lyell. It's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins was devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes that we observe today back through time indefinitely. That way, catastrophes like Noah's flood are strictly ruled out. Now, this process is called science. Science, if you look it up in the dictionary, means knowledge. Science means knowledge. And the scientific principle is that we have to be able to demonstrate it and test it. We got to be able to take it into the laboratory and boil it up in the test tube, and the experiment has to be repeatable by other people before we come to scientific knowledge. It's something that you can see, hear, touch, taste, or smell. It doesn't have anything to do with faith, belief, or religion. All right, so far so good. Now listen to this. Did you know that the sun is shrinking? And a Newswire report made the surprising statement that the sun's diameter appears to have been decreasing by about 0.1% per century. Scientists have been watching for over 100 years now, and the evidence is now conclusive. Every hour, the sun is shrinking by 5 feet. Now, if the sun is shrinking by 0.1% per century, then that totals 1% per millennium. A millennium, boys and girls, is 1,000 years. So if the sun existed only 100,000 years ago, it would have been double its present diameter. 20 million years ago, the surface of the sun would be touching the earth. And as far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage has been consistent since the origin of the sun. Now, when I was a kid, they used to tell us that the sun over there came from the Big Bang. That there was a point in time out here when mass and matter were condensed down to a very tiny ball of mass. And this mass got very, very hot, and it exploded. And it blew out, and that little ball has now expanded into what we can now see in the universe. You know, you look at the sun, the moon, the stars, all the galaxies and quasars and all that material that's out there. That's a big piece of real estate. That's a bunch of stuff out there. All right, so far so good. When did that happen, this Big Bang? Well, when I was a kid, it was 2 billion years ago. When Whitcomb and Morris wrote this book in 63, it was 4.5 billion. The last time I looked, it was up to around 16 billion years ago. A long time ago. Way far back. Now, when was the sun created? Our sun was created when the Big Bang occurred. That's what I was told. Have you got any other information? Nobody could prove it one way or the other, but, you know, what were you told? What did your science textbook tell you? Was it longer than 100,000 years ago? Because, hell, 100,000 years ago, man came on the scene. And in order for there to be life on planet Earth, there has to be a sun. So they tell us that there was life on the planet at least 1 billion years ago. 1 billion, that's 1,000 million. That's a fur piece back, too. So even if you subscribe to the theory that the sun came into existence after the Big Bang by the circulation of giant gas clouds which finally compacted themselves and started the sun. Okay, well, did it occur longer than 100,000 years ago? Because if it did, then the sun, which is about 750,000 miles in diameter, would have been double that size 100,000 years ago. Now, they assure us that the dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago, right? So the sun must have been shining 65 million years ago. Life on this planet depends upon the sun, doesn't it? So 65 million years ago, the sun was shining, and one day an asteroid struck the Earth, blew up, and killed all the dinosaurs. Is that the story you heard? Because that's the story I heard. What's wrong with this story? Because the sun is burning up at the rate of 5 feet an hour. Do the arithmetic. Take 5 feet times 24 hours. Let's just do it. 24 times 5. 24 times 5 is 120 feet per day. Take 120 times 365. That's 120. Times 365, that's 43,800 feet per year. Okay? 43,800 feet per year. Now there's 5,280 feet in a mile. So let's take the 43,800 feet, which is a year, and let's divide that by 5,280. And then we come up with 8.2 miles per year. You follow that? Now, when you got a size of the sun, you know, 750,000 miles in diameter, 8 miles a year is not any big deal. But 8 miles a year starts to add up, like the camel with his nose in the tent. You know, one of these days the camel takes over the tent. Now, the Earth to the sun is about 93 million miles. I mean, if we set off on a journey today and we said, well, we're heading to the sun, it would be a journey of 93 million miles. And you know how the sun circles around the Earth? Oh, excuse me. You know how the Earth circles around the sun? All right. 93 million miles is the diameter. That's the distance from here to the sun, 93 million miles. Now take that 8 miles per year, and you take 20 million years, 8 times 20. What does that get you? 20 million. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 20 million times 8 is 160 million. How far is it to the sun? 93 million. Now, if we were to take the 93 million from the 160, can you see, boys and girls, that just 20 million years ago, the sun was bigger than the distance from the Earth to the sun today? No life could exist on the Earth just 20 million years ago. 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs died out. Well, that's what they tell us. And I could sit here and cite these kinds of crazy numbers that are cited in these science books. Just do the damn arithmetic. Just do the damn arithmetic, and you can see how crazy this whole concept of evolution is. It is stupid, to say the least. And the only people that could believe it would have to come out of public school. You've got to be indoctrinated in public school to believe this kind of horse pucky. And I haven't added anything to the story that came out of the Bible. I'm not adding anything to the story that came from George Gordon. I'm just telling you, here's a Newswire report. The sun is shrinking. So take a look at some science on the sun, and you pick up a book on the sun. I tell you a lot of fascinating information about the sun, and how big it is, and how hot it is, and how it burns, and one thing and another. And it's all good science, and it's all good information. But hey, the sun's burning out, boys and girls. And 65 million years ago at 5 feet a day, let me tell you, the sun was one big piece of real estate. Hell, it was as big as the whole solar system. So you couldn't have any planets out here 65 million years ago because the damn thing was the size of the whole solar system, for crying out loud, or a big portion of it. I didn't do the arithmetic on that, but just do it for yourself. And then people laugh at the Bible? And hey, the Bible may be just crazy as a cut coon, and it may not have one word of truth in it. That's fine. But listen, this so-called crap called evolution doesn't have any more truth than the Bible does. Not one shred more truth. Now, there's some truth in science, but science and evolution don't have any connection whatsoever. None. Evolution's a philosophy, and science is knowledge. What the hell does philosophy have to do with knowledge? Now let's take a look at a little bit more here as it relates to this thing of the size of the ark and how do you deal with 35,000 animals. Now, we don't need 2 million. Some of these guys say you need 2 million animals on the ark. That's not what the Bible calls for. You don't have to take in all the mollusks, the barnacles, and the sponges, and the corals. All of those are aquatic animals. And most of the animal life on planet Earth is in the oceans anyway. All we're talking about is 35,000 land animals. I imagine you had to take a pair of mosquitoes and a pair of fleas and a couple of beetles and a few insects on there. But insects are pretty small. The average size of the animals that went on the ark are the size of a sheep. 35,000 animals the size of a sheep. Now that's what the numbers tell us. And it will fit in 73 railroad cars. So the ideas that people throw out that the ark is too damn small is poppycock. Sharpen your pencil and do the arithmetic. That's all you have to do. So we know, therefore, something of the facts about the migration of some animals, but the means whereby migration is carried out still remain completely unknown. Many theories have been tried, but none of them has been capable of experimental proof. And it is all very puzzling. As far as we know, the bodies of the other mammals are essentially similar to our own, and we flatter ourselves that our brains are more highly developed than the animals around us. And yet these animals that we classify as lower than ourselves can do something, and presumably with their brains, that we humans cannot do, something so far outside of our own experience and abilities that we can't even conceive of how do they do it. Similarly, the phenomenon of hibernation are still not understood. Two of the most active researchers on the subject, professors at Harvard University, say that mammalian hibernation interested many of the earlier zoologists, and sporadic research on the subject has been going on for at least 100 years. Yet the fundamental causes of this condition that we call hibernation are still a mystery. Another authority, Marston Bates of the Rockefeller Foundation, says, "Our knowledge of this mechanism is very incomplete, and perhaps because it represents a field on the borderline between physiology and ecology, and is consequently neglected by both sciences. Various theories have been proposed to account for hibernation, and it seems likely that the controlling stimuli may vary with different animals." And still more recently, a prominent evolutionist, Joseph Wood Crutch, in a popular account of the most recent thinking on the subject, says, "Evolution gives part of the answer when it stresses adaptation. But why in a given instance this adaptation rather than another? It can hardly be just to make the world more interesting, but that's exactly what it does." So it appears, therefore, that the animal world has two powerful means for coping with unfavorable environmental conditions. Hibernation is number one and migration is number two. And it's likely that all animals possess these powers in a latent form, some of them still in active form. And thus far, at least, science has been totally unable to explain either of them, in spite of their great importance in animal physiology and ecology. So there you have it, boys and girls. The answer advanced by Whitcomb and Morris is hibernation. Because it's plain that 8 people could not feed and haul the manure away from 35,000 animals the size of a sheep for 371 days. And that's just where reality is located. And I'm an old-timey farmer, and I'm here to tell you, amen, brother, that ain't going to happen. 8 people ain't going to do that job. Even with a Ford 8-end tractor with a front-end loader on it, they ain't doing that job. But hibernation answers the question. The animals were asleep in their stalls, just like a bear sleeping in a cave for the winter. How long can they hibernate? I don't know. In this case, 371 days. Hey, I'm about out of time again. We're going to have to leave it right there. We'll be back with more on the Genesis flood and the science behind the Noah flood, or the Noachian deluge, as it's called, next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Okay, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So thanks for listening, and until then, good night, friends.